pussy sweeter than McCready when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area in earlier times, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll continue reading excerpts from When Chapel Hill Was a Village by Cornelia Spencer Love, published in 1976 by the Chapel Hill Historical Society. Parson Moss. The Presbyterian preacher was a middle-aged expatriate, Canadian, with reddish hair, sloping shoulders, and a hail fellow well-met cordiality which was very endearing. His sermons were interesting and to the point. He called no man a sinner. In fact, many newcomers with no binding church affiliation would attend his church and become known as Mossites. Since he had no visible wife, the manse was rented, and he lived with the Kinnetts across the way. He was a popular diner out and left cheery words and good feelings wherever he went. I liked him, but never became an ardent disciple. I did, however, become a friend of Miss Ernestine Noah, brought to Chapel Hill by Dr. Branson, who was building up his new Department of Rural Social Economics. Miss Noah was a very bright woman, whose mother lived with her in the old Mangum house. What their ethnic origin was, I have no idea. The old mother looked foreign, and one of our doctors insisted that she falsely accused the Eubanks drugstore of selling her the wrong prescription, and tried to sue them. Without success. Dr. Moss dined frequently with the Noahs, and then we heard that he and Ernestine were engaged. She announced it happily, bought herself a trousseau, and invited her friends in to see it, including Mrs. Stacy, the Dean of Women. Then, suddenly, nothing more was heard. The Noahs packed up and went away. Dr. Branson may have known the whole story, but the town never heard it. What was rumored was that Dr. Moss had a wife in Washington, a Catholic, previously divorced. He could not commit bigamy, but what happened between him and Miss Noah was never made public. At the time of his death, the Washington wife is supposed to have claimed his body, but he was never denounced or disgraced. I felt that Miss Noah had a very raw deal. She just vanished with no explanation. It all happened a long time ago. Commencement balls in 1909. In 1909, my father's class at the University of North Carolina was having its 25th reunion, and Kemp Davis Battle, former President Battle's grandson, was graduating and invited me to attend his commencement balls. We had never met, but I was just 17 and loved to dance. It was a delightful prospect. Dr. and Mrs. Battle invited us to stay at their home, the handsome old house on the edge of the campus, which is now the Baptist Student Union. Dr. Battle was a charming old gentleman who loved to tell jokes, which his wife, a sweet, long-faced lady, never seemed to comprehend. I think this added to his amusement in telling them. He refused to wear false teeth, but would manage by eating just one food at a time. They had a nice housekeeper, Miss Susie Thompson, and a fat old black cook named Easter. The dances were held on the 2 days following commencement, afternoon and evening on one day, morning, afternoon, and evening the next, and the belles of the state, in many cases already engaged to their senior hosts, attended. Some of the undergraduates stayed over for the balls, so there was no lack of stags. The university was greatly criticized by the Baptists, Methodists, and Presbyterians for holding these dances. They considered it a wicked place, and could make their anger known when the legislature met to allot funds. But the students were allowed to have them, in a wooden building, commons, just off the edge of the campus, whose domain was thus saved from being defiled. K.D., as my host Kemp Davis Battle was called, presented me with 5 dance cards, already filled out. He was taking me to one of the dances, four of his friends to the others. This was a very happy arrangement for a stranger. Her partner, with her name on his card, would seek her out for each dance, which were arranged in groups of three called lead, break, and general. For the lead, partners formed a long line and marched around the hall before dancing. Only in the break was cutting in allowed. General was dancing with your current partner only. These rules prevented the later custom, which nearly broke up the dances, in which breaks were allowed all the time, and the host of a very popular girl hardly got a chance to dance with her at all. This led later to monopolizing the same girl for a whole weekend, which could be equally tiresome. A young sophomore cousin of mine, in the class of 43, said to me, "When I put that girl on a bus to go back to Charlotte, I never wanted to see her again." But to return to 1909, certain seniors had been chosen to be marshals and were accoutred in their regalia, beribboned straps worn over their shoulders, in the manner of the Knights of the Garter. I was greatly impressed by the dignified manner of John Manning, the chief marshal. At the last dance, which was for marshals only, each placed his regalia over the shoulder of the lady of his choice, and they took the floor. Earlier there had been a German, with favors bestowed on selected damsels. I was taken to one of the afternoon dances by a certain Will Woodard, tall, dark, and very good-looking, but I was frightened off when he took me to a bench in the Arboretum and seemed about to make a pass. This was something new to me, and I must have frightened him off for good, for he never approached me again thereafter. Another partner was Costner, or Costi, who came for me in a horse-driven barouche. All these men wore dress suits, and the girls beautiful light dresses, with slippers to match. We danced waltzes and one-steps to such music as "I Wonder Who's Kissing Her Now." At the final ball, we danced until the sun came shining through the windows. What a thrill to describe to my New England friends in Cambridge! Negroes in Chapel Hill. The first one I knew anything about was Dilsey Craig, who was the servant in my great-grandparents' home in Chapel Hill, where the houses now live. At the time Lincoln freed the slaves, James Phillips gave her the first $5 gold piece that came into his possession, and she stayed with his family until old age compelled retreat to her cabin. She was greatly beloved, and my grandmother, Cornelia P. Spencer, would not leave Chapel Hill to join her daughter in Cambridge as long as Aunt Dilsey was living. She and her husband had no children of their own, but they adopted a son, John Caldwell, whose many descendants continue to live in Chapel Hill. When I arrived there in 1917 to take a job in the university library and went up to the room engaged for me at Miss Mary Manning's, a black girl was putting wood into the little round stove. "What is your name?" I said. "Cornelia Caldwell." Her sister Julia cooked for the Mangums for many years. Sam was a gardener. At last count, his descendants still lived on the site of Aunt Dilsey's cabin, the turnoff on Franklin just beyond the Glen. There was another Caldwell family, perhaps distantly related, whose present descendants include Lucille Caldwell, head of the Roberson Street Center in the 50s and early 60s, and later a worker for the Red Cross in Vietnam, a very able woman who kept the accounts straight for us when the A.D. Clark Pool was being built. She is the sister of Edwin Caldwell, a prominent and useful citizen. His wife, Pearl, carries on the catering service started by her mother, Alice Neal, who had cooked for both Presidents Chase and Graham. They live in their home on Caldwell Street, which was probably named for them, and their son, Edwin, Jr., is likewise a power in the community. Probably the name Caldwell derives from the first university president, as slaves frequently took the surnames of their masters. The progenitor of this family was Minnie Caldwell, a very handsome mulatto woman who in 1917 was the town beauty parlor, going from home to wash, not set, ladies' hair. Minnie used to come to my room to wash my hair, but this ceased when I let her have an old winter coat which she was to pay for in shampooing. She never came any more. But by that time I could take Colonel Pendergraft, or Kern's, bus to Durham for a complete hairdo. A very smart family were the Joneses. One sister, Maggie Booth, was a dressmaker, so popular that she had to be engaged weeks ahead, and I, a newcomer, never even tried to compete with the town matrons. Mrs. T.J. Wilson used to say that her dresses fit and looked well, except that they had to be sort of held up at one place. Emma Jones was the Klutz's excellent cook. Monumental. Stolid. Jim Blacknell was a big, jolly old fellow, a skilled layer of rock walls, the dry kind, without cement, who brought up his large family several miles out in the country. He announced to Mrs. Klutz's roomful of boarders that he had just had his 16th child on his 60th birthday. His oldest son still carries on his father's trade. When Phillips Russell and I wanted to have the top layer of the wall around the Phillips Cemetery lot rebuilt, it having been damaged by viewers of the tennis matches across the way, Jim fixed it with sharp-pointed rocks, which would effectively discourage any prospective gallery. Uncle George collected household garbage for his pig, and could frequently be seen about town with his smelly bucket on his arm. He also fired the Mangum's furnace, but he came later and later of a morning, until finally Mrs. Mangum gave him an alarm clock. Again he would be late, so she asked him if he was using her gift. "Yes, ma'am, I set it every night, but after it goes off, I take me a little back nap." He was very fond of the Mangums, and would say, "Miss Laura, she's a mother to me, and Mr. Charlie, he's a father." Rhodes Markham was a small, taciturn man with a tiny nose, who was said to be of Indian descent. He was an expert gardener and worked for Dr. W. C. Coker. His daughter, Savannah, looked exactly like him, and she, too, varied in her moods. She cooked for the Days for many years and adored Billy Day, but was contemptuous of Alice, who could give out good old Virginia recipes, but was innocent of the slightest knowledge of cooking. After Dr. Day's death, Savannah stayed on with his wife, but was really so mean to her that I lost all feelings of friendship toward her. Once, a long time ago, I was having a midday meal with the Venables, when the noise of a passing plane made us all rush into the garden to see the strange sight. The little old black cook came, too. She saw the small flying object, cocked a quizzical eye at us, and said, "You mean to tell me there's a man in that?" Clearly she didn't believe any such nonsense, and thought less of us for suggesting it. Aunt Lucy Reed worked for the Farrars, my next-door neighbors on Laurel Hill Road, and agreed, with their permission, to give me an hour or so for cleaning every morning. It was most convenient for me, as I was at work in the library, and Jim Blacknell built several neat stone steps to connect our properties. Lucy had diabetes, but she was so scrupulous in diet and medicine-taking that she lived way up into the 90s, under the care of her daughter, Leanna Cotton. She was such a neat, clean, decent old woman. Leanna still sends me Christmas cards. When I returned in 1923 from a trip to Europe, Dr. Wilson introduced me to a new library janitor, saying, "I think you'll like him." Dr. Wilson said to call him Clark, which he deemed more fitting than his first name, Adolphus. He had been in the First World War, stationed in France. He remained in library service until his retirement, being put in charge of the mailing department as a regular member of the staff. As a Christian gentleman, a man of integrity, Clark ranks high among people I've known. He's worked for his church, for a retirement home for black clergymen, for the A.D. Clark Pool, and other projects at the Hargraves Center, formerly the Roberson Street Recreation Center, and for just about every worthy project our black community has ever undertaken. In April 1975, he was 85 years old. His wife, Ethel, who died in 1973, taught school out in the country. Her training was meager, and her spelling not always impeccable, but she cared for her little pupils, saw that shoes were provided for a barefooted family, and when a mother had child after child, in ignorance and poverty, Ethel Clark did something about it. She told me what was needed, and I gave her $3 for a diaphragm. When the swimming pool was built at the recreation center, she organized a group of women to plant and tend flowers and shrubs on the grounds. She and her husband, although having little education, had a wealth of character. The Mangums. The old Mangum House, so-called from the professor who taught in the university 100 years ago, was later bought by Betty Smith, but when I came to Chapel Hill in 1917, it was owned by Adolphus Mangum's children, and every summer was occupied by two of them, Etty Mangum and Minnie Wilson, and Minnie's jovial Methodist minister husband, Nath. A long, narrow porch stretched across the front, and many was the summer evening when I sat there with Miss Etty, vigorously plying a palm-leaf fan and listening to the stories of her youth. She was not bragging, she was telling, and I know that what she said was true. The commencement balls were held every year, and it was a badge of beldam to receive the handsome regalia bestowed by the ball marshals. Miss Etty, her name was Juliet, but she was never called by that name, received more of these sashes over the years than any other girl. She had a trunk full of them. But her people were Methodist. To dance was a sin. She never attended a ball. The regalia were brought to her at her home by the student beaux. And she never married. She never told her age either, and made the Wilsons promise not to put it on her tombstone, which so stands in the Mangum lot in the old cemetery. Charles was the brother of Etty and Minnie. He was a professor of anatomy at the medical school, and lived with his wife Laura and son Charlie in his own home next to Vernon Howell. Behind it was a deep and beautiful garden, Mrs. Mangum's province, where she cultivated many seasonal shrubs and flowers. It was a delight to stroll down the paths of a summer evening and hear her talk about them, in her melodious alto voice, which she would raise only when escorting their loved collie, Nancy, on a similar excursion, and exhort her to do business for Miss Laura. This greatly tickled the neighbors, but Mrs. Mangum would have been deeply mortified had she realized the carrying powers of her voice. The son, Charlie, was about 15 when I first knew him, a young fellow with a brilliant mind, but alas, he was a spastic, with little control over his movements or voice, and Dr. and Mrs. Mangum devoted their lives to him, wheeling him everywhere. Later they had a Ford car, waiting on him, scrimping and saving to provide for his future when they would be gone. This was before Dr. Carlson had published his book, which taught that a spastic child should be allowed to struggle for himself, try to dress, try to crawl, in this way using muscles that in the course of time would be strengthened and hardened until they became of some use. Dr. Carlson learned this because he was the spastic son of a widow who had to work to earn their living, and was compelled to leave her little boy to himself much of the time. When grown, he became a specialist in his disease, and wrote about his hard-earned capabilities. Charlie Mangum had tutors at home, went to the university, earned an A.B., L.L.B., and J.D., and wrote several legal research volumes, for which he received a modest stipend. He played a cagey game of bridge, and in chess must have ranked close to a master. His father was a cheery optimist who would tell you what wholehearted pleasure he took in his store teeth. He said his class in the front room of Caldwell Hall could not settle down to work until they had watched the daily passionate parting between an engaged young couple outside. He went with his son to many of his law classes, taking notes for him, and would say that if medicine failed him, he thought he knew enough law to make a pretty good lawyer. When I was welcomed into the Mangum's circle, I would be called in to play bridge, listen to some of their lovely records, Alma Gluck, Louise Homer, Caruso, Schumann Heink, or perhaps go with them to the movies. And how we enjoyed that golden age of comedy, with Harold Lloyd, Buster Keaton, Mickey Rooney, and all the rest. We used to say that Dr. Mangum looked like Lewis Stone, the father of Andy Hardy, and both were indeed distinguished gentlemen. Tall, white-haired, well-groomed, Dr. Mangum never was seen on the campus in anything but immaculate clothes and well-polished shoes. Some of my best friends in later life I met in the Mangum home. It was a center for friendly, interesting people. This story has no happy ending. Dr. Mangum, overworked as dean of the medical school, after living through the depression years when he had to fight for the very existence of the two-year school, was the first to go. His wife carried on bravely, but finally was sent to the state hospital in Raleigh, where she was kindly treated and, happily, unaware of her surroundings, although she always knew Charlie when he was brought to see her. Though she called both her husband and son Charles, she always maintained that the inflection of her voice showed which one she meant. Country Families. The Thompsons and Johnstons had lived in Orange County for many years, and were friends of my family more than 100 years ago. The Henry Thompsons lived first in Chapel Hill, owning the land later divided between the Woolens and Drew Pattersons, across from the Episcopal Church, and now belonging to the Chi Omegas. Later, they moved to a place some miles out in the country, the nearest post office being at Eflind. When I saw it, there was a grove of beautiful old oak trees grouped around a house of the then-popular plan, two stories with central hall, having two rooms on each side with a porch at the end. Off to one side there was a small vine-covered brick kitchen. In 1917, here lived three Thompson sisters, Miss Susie, who had formerly kept house for Dr. and Mrs. Battle, Florabelle, a teacher who was the live wire of the family, and sweet-smiling, mute Miss Ida. There had been a fourth sister who married one of my father's classmates. She was no longer living, but her son, Edward Carr, made himself known to me and used to escort me to football games. My mother had taught all the girls in a small school at her home, and when she came to Chapel Hill in 1919 to pay me a visit, nothing could stand in the way of our going out to see the Thompsons. There were few cars in Chapel Hill, and the roads were rough, but we found a certain Jack Sparrow who was willing to make the trip. How my mother enjoyed seeing these friends of her youth, and how we also enjoyed their fried chicken, biscuits, and candied yams. I didn't have a car of my own for 10 years, and by that time the Thompsons were no more. Their place was bought by Frank Umstead, and the adjoining land, the old Hicks place, was bought by his father, John Umstead. I hope those priceless trees are still standing. On this visit, her last, for she died in 1920, my mother found two changes in Chapel Hill which met with her disapproval. She thought the two-bedroom wing which Dr. Venable had added to the old Phillips house ruined the looks of the place, and she could not get over the Hickerson house, built on what had been her lovely flower garden, behind the House of Seven Gables, which she and Lee had built when they were married. This made her so mad that she would never speak of poor innocent Felix by his rightful name, but would allude to him as that Nickerson, or Dickerson. To go back in time, Squire Johnston and his family lived only a few miles out in the country, where much later the Nathan Wamacks built on part of their land. The family was a large one, with sons and daughters divided into two cultures, those who farmed and those who were college-bred and taught. Mrs. Johnston, who had been a Hughes, was educated at one of the female academies, which constituted the most education a woman could get in North Carolina in that pre- and post-bellum time. She was a bright old woman, a widow living in her lifelong home with several of her children, when I knew her. This house varied from the usual country plan in that it had a long front porch, the width of the house, on which hall, parlor, and bedrooms opened directly. I had already known her oldest son, Charles Hughes Johnston, a graduate of the university who had come to Cambridge to assist my father in running an earlier Harvard summer school. He met his future wife, Nell Bomar of Spartanburg, in our parlor. Later, they both taught educational psychology at the University of Illinois, and later still, I had the pleasure of welcoming one of their grandsons to the University of North Carolina. The oldest Johnston daughter, Mary, stolid and inarticulate, lived at home and never married. Her farmer brother Sam did the same. While George went to college, Elizabeth married David Patterson and taught kindergartners in Hillsboro, and Annie married a forester who, for some years, showed the Haitians how to care for their trees. John was the rambunctious one who got into minor trouble in the army when he cut up his blanket to make puttees. James, the youngest member of the family, turned out to be the flower of the flock. He lived in Washington, was a whiz in the investment market, and on his death left millions of dollars to set up scholarships at the university, on the pattern of the Moorheads. When I was in Washington some years ago, he invited me to dinner at his handsome home, sending a car with chauffeur to fetch me, and with his stylish and charming wife entertained me in royal style. Yes, this was James Johnston, born on an Orange County farm where the chickens scratched the ground bare in the front yard, who had made his way to prosperity and benefaction in the best American tradition. Franklin Street Shops. The old post office stood about where the downtown one is now, a small wooden building where everybody went to collect their mail. Those in university buildings sent their janitors, carrying large canvas bags. I may not be naming the stores in exact order, or even in chronological coexistence, but this is not important. Near the Presbyterian Church, the old wooden one, which later was burned down, was Abbs, Abernathy's bookshop, which in time moved up the block and became the Intimate. Ab made money, in spite of his lax business methods, co-sponsored a unique magazine, Contempo, then sold out and moved to New York, where I heard he did very well, in real estate, or was it investments? He seemed to be a curious mixture of simplicity and shrewdness. Kemp's first record shop was in part of Ab's, and was a very popular place. He also had some beautiful jade that he had collected, but most of this was stolen. Mr. Sorrell had a tiny jewelry and watch repair shop, which you visited often if he was working on your watch, for he never would say when it would be finished. The prime mender of clocks and watches was Mr. Squires, up a long flight of stairs and down a long hall. He also kept bees, and would display a row of bottles containing honeycomb and honey on his windowsill. He offered Mrs. Day a bottle, for which she thanked him, and started to take away with her, until Mr. Squires made clear that it was a sale, not a gift, so she politely gave it back. Ledbetter Pickard was our only stationery shop, long before Hallmark cards were invented. It has enlarged and added counters until you can hardly get from one end of it to the other, but I always found it a very useful shop, with such pleasant young women, in later years, to wait on me. Mr. Ledbetter's mother kept the last student's boarding house that I know of. The first cafeteria was opened, a few restaurants, and students were less and less inclined to take their meals at one place. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening.
I think we can hear what I say. Nothing could be finer than to be in Carolina in the morning.